Well, today we're covering Exodus 32 to 40, and there's a lot in this section. So obviously we're not going to be able to deal with it in a lot of detail, and you'll see the bits I haven't dealt with in detail, and that might be another series another time. It begins with threat, a great threat to the promises of the Lord through Israel sinning, but ends gloriously with the presence of the glory of the Lord with his people in the tabernacle. Quite a section. So there's a list of the chapters and their content. We're really not going to do a lot from chapter 35 through to 39. We're just really going to refer to that. That will be the section that we kind of jump over. Feel a bit bad, but there's just so much in the other chapters. And I really like preaching on narrative. So there we go. Yeah. So between the extraordinary events of chapter 24, remember what happened in chapter 24? The Lord came down with the book of the law from the mountain, and he read it to the people, and then the covenant was sealed with blood, and then Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders are called up onto the mountain to eat in the Lord's presence, and then Moses then goes further up onto the mountain where he's going to receive instructions for the design of the tabernacle. Where God's presence is going to dwell with his people. So that's an extraordinary chapter 24. And between there and the opening of chapter 32, there's not been much narrative. And for this reason, the words that open chapter 32 are particularly shocking. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." It's actually quite shocking to hear that. It's almost as shocking as hearing Genesis 1 and 2 and then reading Genesis 3. It's that kind of shock. The last time we heard the people of Israel speaking was their good pledge and vow at the covenant ceremony. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. And these are the very next words we hear them say. Quite something, isn't it? Such a turn. Like the sin in Eden, this turn on the part of the people is completely inexplicable. It's amazing how often in the scriptures there's good beginnings that end so abruptly, so disastrously. There's Eden, there's here, there's in some ways the Davidic kingship, there's the birth of the nation with Solomon, and that ends disastrously with his son. There's a really good new beginning that doesn't end disastrously. It's called the incarnation of the Son of God, but it's faced with all the temptations that the others all stumble at. So the incarnation is really an extraordinary thing. It's a new beginning that doesn't end in death. It's really wonderful. Anyway, each of those turns is completely inexplicable. There's really no reason for it. The people do have a rationalisation for it. The people saw that Moses delayed to come down the mountain. They seem to be blaming Moses. As for this Moses, you couldn't really be more dismissive, could you? As for this Moses. Anyway, it's a good question as to whether it's delay or if it's simply impatience on their part. What are they actually looking for? Is it impatience? Is it delay if Moses is up there listening to the Lord, telling what the Lord has to tell him? That's not delay at all. That's just called obedience. He's doing what the people said they would do, or that the Lord has said. We will do, and we will be fully obedient. That's what Moses is doing. He's embodying that up on the mountain. Who sets the timetable for the making of the royal priesthood and the holy nation? Have you ever been impatient with the people of God? Well, who sets the timetable? You would think it was the one to whom these people are a special possession, wouldn't you? I would, and yet I find that so often that's not the way I act. I've got my timetable. Aaron, in the face of their hostility towards Moses and their imperiousness to him, up! Stop sitting around, Aaron! Get up! Make us. They're very imperious, really. It's a mob. Well, they cave into the demand. Never a good idea to cave into mobs. I think that would be the story, that would be the lesson of our age. It's never a good idea to cave into mobs. Anyway, he does. He caves into the demand. He takes their gold and jewellery, plundered from the Egyptians. What was that gold for, by the way? That's right. It's actually been, Moses has actually been told about the covering for the ark and the golden altar. So that's actually, that plunder was actually ought to be brought into the worship of the Lord in the tabernacle. And now here it's going to be used this other way. And he melts it down and fashions it into a calf. The calf in the ancient world was a symbol of power, of strength, of military conquest and of divinity. So all of that thing said about the calf. So what you've got here is Israel saying, well, we're a nation and we want all the trappings of being a strong and leading nation. That's really what they're saying. And and so that's why they want the calf. It shows the desire for the visible trappings of power rather than what's Israel's real source of its nationhood. It's not through its military strength, it's through its obedience. Remember, you may know later in Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 14, there's the law for the king. You know what he's forbidden to do? Build a mighty army. He's forbidden to do that. You know what he's commanded to do? He's make a copy of the law and have it with him all the time. That tells you what the nation is really meant to be about. Some of the church gets sucked into that. We want to be strong and we want to have influence. We want to be influencers in this world. The only thing we are called to be is obedient. The people of God who do his will. That's what we're called to be. Other than that is idolatry. So they're called to obedience and dependence on the invisible Lord who can only be known through his word and acts and not be manipulated into any of them. That's the other thing about idolatry, is if we kind of get it all going, we'll get God to do what we want him to do. No, God does what he does, and we're meant to do what he tells us to do, not him doing what we tell him to do. Aaron attempts to draw lines between their idolizing of the calf and the worship of the Lord. So in a way, he tries to turn their spirituality in a good direction. Spirituality is near. Like, we talk a lot these days about not being religious, being spiritual. We talk about, you know, people aren't interested in church, they're more interested in spirituality. Look, spirituality, by and large in the world, is idolatrous.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that Aaron is foolish. He's trying to baptize this idolatrous spirituality into some kind of form of the worship of the Lord. But you cannot do that. You cannot take an idolatry, which is all very spiritual, and make it serve God. It's an impossibility. What he does is he tries to link it with a festival to the Lord. So they say, they see the cup, they say, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And then Aaron, when he saw this, he built an altar before the land, you know where the altar is meant to be, before the ark, the invisible God, the God who you don't see, and said, made a proclamation, said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. So he blurs the distinctions, as though he can somehow just turn it in a good direction, you know. The only thing you can actually do with idolatry that's really useful for idolatry is crucify it. You can only kill it. It's the only good thing you can do with idolatry. Okay, you cannot reshape it into some kind of pseudo-Christian thing. The festival that they have, they rose up the next day, they burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. What does that sound like? Chapter 24, when they made the covenant with the Lord and said, oh, everything you do will obey. The young men had sacrificed burnt offerings and peace offerings. So they have this, and then it says they rose up to play. Some people have taken that to mean a kind of sexual orgy. Probably what it is, because that word play is used in Exodus elsewhere in terms of fighting. So probably they kind of have their own version of the Edinburgh military tattoo. They're probably actually going around marching and chanting and singing their nationalistic songs and celebrating their strength. That's probably what's going on. They're playing. They may even have like an Olympic Games, you know, wrestling and so on. It's a great festival of strength is what goes on there. Paul uses these events to speak warning to the Christians in Corinth and so to us as readers of that letter. In 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6, 13 to 13, he says that these events were written down as examples for us so that we might not desire evil as those who did these things did and who suffered severe discipline from the Lord. That's the example and that's the warning in them. That's what we're meant to learn from them. So he begins, that's how he introduces it in verse 6, and then in verse, stick with my notes. Turning to idols is an expression of worldly wisdom. That's Romans 1, 22-23. Becoming foolish to darken the darkened minds. I'll read it. All these passages that you know well and that you can never remember them. You find that all the time. Although they knew God, they didn't honour him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals like calves and creeping things. So idolatry is deeply linked to a claim to be wise. So, you know, nationalism and militarism is a claim to be wise. We know what it takes to survive in this world. We know what you have to be a strong nation. It's a wisdom claim. And that's what's happening here. And because it's worldly wisdom, it's not wisdom from above, it is earthly, unspiritual and devilish. That's what our human wisdom is. And it leads to disorder and every vile practice. And when you read Romans 1 going on, you see every vile practice. And James really kind of links divisiveness and fighting and bitterness to that worldly wisdom. So maybe all the wisdom that we've got in our culture, which seems to be producing fighting and bitterness and factionalism and divisions, maybe what we're calling wisdom is no wisdom, no real wisdom. In his word to Moses about what's happening, so up on the mountain, everything is open to the Lord. Nothing is hidden from his eyes. He's up there. The Lord says that the people have corrupted. The word there can mean ruined or destroyed themselves. In the verses that follow in Paul's letter in Corinthians, Paul then lists four events from the travels from Egypt to the Promised Land that are warning examples. He begins here in verse 7 with this event at Sinai. Then in verse 8, he goes to Numbers 25. So he gets almost to the Promised Land. You know, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they're going to be right on the border of the Promised Land. And There he speaks of a widespread immorality that sweeps through the people, linked with Baal worship. Generally, Baal was figured as a calf or a bull, by the way. Then he heads back to Numbers 21, where they test God. And then he comes back even further to Numbers 14, and he speaks about them grumbling against Moses. And then he uses those four examples, Sinai, 25, 21, 14, as ways of examples of don't do this. They're warnings for us. It's an interesting way to do it, to begin here at Sinai and then to go almost to the end of the trip and then work your way back towards Sinai. Like if it was there, I would have gone Exodus 14, 21, 25. But it kind of goes, and what he's doing is, I think Paul is actually bringing us an arrow, zing. So we start here, that's where it all comes from. It's not like a progression. Every vile and disordered practice comes out of idolatry, out of worldly wisdom. And so he sees idolatry as the root of every evil practice. And that's really what Romans 1 is saying. And that until idolatry is rooted out and destroyed, all other disorder and wrongfulness will keep rearing its head. So we live in an age where the church has been deeply impacted by widespread immorality. It's only been going on for about 40 or 50 years. But, that's all. Well, we haven't dealt with it, have we? Have we been trying to deal with it? On and off, yes. But have we got anywhere? Well, maybe it's because we're tackling the wrong thing. Maybe it keeps resurging because we haven't killed the root. I've got boysenberries at home. Greg Pierce very kindly gave me some when we moved in. And we planted them, and boy, they love Strathalbyn climate. They love it, you know. So I've dug them out because they're vicious things, but they just spread everywhere. They're really into my vegetable patch. Excuse me. Anyway, so I keep digging it out. The thing is, unless you get the whole root, yeah, they'll just keep coming back. They're survivors, and that they're made to survive because their roots break really easily to leave a little bit in, a bit that you can't see. Yeah. Now I've been resisting the temptation to go the roundup way, but maybe there's some godly wisdom in it. I don't know. So we'll see. I'm giving no. So you've got to get the root, and here's the root. It's idolatry, which is really just the rejection of the Lord, which then has to fill itself with something. No wonder John says, as his last word in his first epistle, little children, keep yourselves from idols. It all goes kaput if that happens. So the church loves power, the church loves money, if the church loves its autonomy, it's going to go to put, and all kinds of disordered practice will arise from it. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven. That's how Paul has introduced that section from Romans 1. Here on the mountain, nothing is hidden from the Lord, and he urges Moses to leave him alone so that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. So he's going to say, wipe them off, start again with you. But Moses refused to. Instead, staying with the Lord to plead for mercy for the people. I'll just read that little section. Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people, whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? The Lord actually just told him why. They've made this golden calf and they said, that's your gods, O Israel. The Lord actually said that to Moses. Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven. And all this land that I've promised I'll give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. That's his prayer. It's quite a prayer, isn't it? I think it's a beautiful prayer. And so Moses' main concern is not actually the people or himself in that prayer. He's really concerned for the honour of God. If the Egyptians see this, they'll say, see, he just brought them out to destroy them in the wilderness. So it's really the honour of God's name. God, if you do this, your name will be mud in the nations. And it's to the covenant that Moses refers as he pleads that the Lord relent. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. That's really interesting. Like, what is it normally? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah. It's only four times in the Bible where Abraham, Isaac, and Israel are listed like that. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But remember, before you do, that the wonderful series on Jacob that you heard last year from some preacher. Remember, where does Jacob's name turn from Jacob to Israel? After he's wrestled, after he's wrestled with the Lord at the river Jabbok, and that is when Jacob is broken. That's when Jacob finally becomes not the setter of his own course, but the one who will trust in the Lord. So it's really significant to say Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. He's refusing. Moses is refusing to relate to the people as sinners, but as covenant people. That's what he's doing here. It's a strongly covenantal way of speaking. And it calls on God to look into his people as the post-wrestling people, people in whom the grace of God has come to its goal. The other places where the list is like this, 1 Kings 18:36, where Elijah is battling the false prophets, and he calls on the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel to act to vindicate his name. And it's in 1 Corinthians 29:18, where David prays following the collection for the rebuilding, for the building of the temple. So it's quite closely linked here, really. It's got the tabernacle and then the temple, and then it's in also in 2 Chronicles 30:6, when Hezekiah summoned survivors of the Assyrian assault to gather again for Passover. So it's really very strongly covenantal. This is the prayer that the Lord was looking for, and he relents from beginning again just with Moses. So he relents from that. He's not going to do that. He will not destroy the people. Moses returns to the people with the Holy Writ, the covenant law inscribed on stone by the finger of God. And when, so his return sees his anger burn hot against them. The Lord's anger was burning hot. Now, he sees actually what's going on, and in a way he's actually brought into the anger of God. He feels it in his own bones. I don't know if he handles it as well as the Lord. He smashes the stone at the foot of the mountain. That's where the people should have been waiting to hear what the Lord, all that the Lord has said we will do. What's he saying to Moses? They're not there. They're marching up and down and singing their jingoistic songs. He destroys the calf. He burns it, grinds it down, and turns it into powder that scatters on water that the people then have to drink. There's a lot of comment on that in some of the commentaries. The drinking of the water will make obvious just who are the really guilty ones here. Remember in Numbers 5, there's a test for a person who may have been adulterous. There's an accusation of adultery, and the dust of the tabernacle is to be used in water, and the accuser and the accused are both to drink it. Oh, no, just the accused is meant to drink it, and that will show one way or another whether the person is guilty or not. So maybe this is to highlight who the ringleaders are. That's reading a lot in, don't know. Aaron is confronted with his role in this shame, and he misrepresents what happens. He's such a weak man, Aaron. So he caves in, and then he says, "I didn't do it really." And, you know, in a way, he almost blames God. "I just threw it in, and out came the calf." I really thought it was the Lord's leading to do that. Ever heard that or said that? You know, it's funny how so often the Lord's leading is kind of what we want to do in the first place, you know, for one reason or another. Aaron is confronted, and he misrepresents what happened. The people had broken loose with Aaron's weakly benign benediction. You can just see him at that feast. "You're all doing very well. God bless you all." You know, pathetic. You know, breaking loose, interesting word, it can refer to the letting down of hair that's tied up, sort of shaking your hair loose. There's that idea. Can also mean to act as leader. To act as leader. That's what the people are doing. In, you know, Moses is going to say, "We'll take the lead." In fact, pretty well everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes. Then Moses calls any who are on the Lord's side to come to him. It's a real opportunity for the whole nation to repent, if they would. Only the Levites do so, and they're called to the holy task of searching for the rebel leaders and putting them to death. They're told to gird on their swords and to go and to do so quite impartially, even if it were a brother or a companion or a neighbour, but to put them to death. Now, to me, you can hear that it can sound a bit like, say, the genocide in Rwanda, where regardless of relationship, you know, people were put to death. You know, we read that it is fearsome. There is a trajectory in the scriptures that begins with this kind of justice and judgment. This is justice and judgment being accepted, but it's a trajectory where the use of the sword, finally you get a prophecy that says, "Awake, O sword, and strike the shepherd," and really a prophecy of Christ. So this trajectory of judgment and justice being worked out, it finally reaches its great goal, really, in the justice and judgment that's worked out in Jesus Christ. But then you get into the New Testament and it says that the sword is given to the government, isn't it? So there is a place for judgment and justice to be worked out. It's complicated and we really don't have all the time to go in there today. But certainly what happens, though, is that the Lord doesn't condemn what Moses and the Levites do. In fact, he rewards the Levites. They're given the rewards then of being ordained into the Lord's service. Faithful in this, they'll be faithful in the Lord's service in the temple, in the tabernacle and later the temple. So they have a special job. What do the Levites do in the tabernacle, do you know? They set it up and they pack it up. They set it up and they pack it up and they carry it around. You know, nothing in a way grand. They're kind of like the people who come in here and set up the chairs each week and put them away, you know. Nothing grand, but it's grand. The people are then faced up by Moses with their sin. And so the next day he says, "You've sinned a great sin. And now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for you." The Lord is clear. Those who sinned will be blotted out from his book. So he goes up and he says, "Alas to the Lord, this people has sinned a great sin." It's the first time so far that he's spoken about their sinning. Uh, they've made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin, so he doesn't even finish, but if not, please blot me out of the book you've written. That's quite something, isn't it? It's me and them, or it's not me. It's really, you know, and I think he's been pressed by what has happened into an extraordinary truth that's in the heart of God. It's me and you, or it's not me, is really the heart of God to this sinful humanity. Moses, the Lord does say, though, whoever has sinned against me, I'll blot out of my book. But now go lead the people to the place about which you've spoken. Behold, my angel shall go before you, which makes me reconsider about the angel that we talked about last week. The you there is plural, so it could be that Moses is the angel still, but it doesn't quite read that way, does it? Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. In other words, okay, I'm not going to blot them out. I'm not going to wipe them out. But there is still a judgment. In the day that I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. And then the very next thing you hear about a plague that comes on the people, and many die. As he speaks with Moses, the Lord has not reversed his purpose to not destroy Israel and begin again. He's already said that to Moses, hasn't he? Judgment is not rejection by God, but his holy covenant jealousy in action. So what's going on here is not the rejection of evil, of Israel, even the sending of the plague. It's not the rejection of Israel. His judgment is part of his covenant jealousy. Jealousy is a really good thing. Jealousy is not envy. Envy is never good. Jealousy can be good or bad. Envy is never good. That's when you see something that someone else has and you want it. Jealousy is when you've got something that belongs to you and you want to keep it. And the Lord's jealousy is, I've got these people, I'm going to keep them. Marriage jealousy is good jealousy. There's jealousies that are really good. There are jealousies which are just selfishness. Verse 33:1-3 makes it clear why the Lord's going to send an angel. The risk for the people for the Lord to be with them. So he's not going to go with them, he'll send an angel instead. The risk for the people for the Lord to be with them is that their sinfulness may lead to their destruction by his holiness. So the Lord said to Moses, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt. He's still kind of putting it in Moses' basket. You did it, Moses, you brought them up. And every time he does that, Moses seems to come back with, no, they're your people and you brought them up. Yeah. Could have gone to his head, yeah, I'm the rescuer. But Moses is really clear, I'm not the rescuer, you're the rescuer. Verse 2, I'll send an angel before you, I'll drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hevites and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you're a stiff-necked people. So that's the reason why it's just going to send an angel. But that's not good enough for Moses. Look at verse 4. When the people heard this disastrous word, to them that sounds like the Lord's going to send an angel and he's going to drive them out, he's going to bring them to the promised land, but he's not going to go up among them. And to they hear that as a disastrous word. There's something much worse than death. And there's something much more important than just getting to the promised land and having all the goodies and being protected. The thing worse is abandonment by the Lord. The thing better is the presence of the Lord. They mourn, not dressing themselves up in their ornaments. So the calf hadn't taken all of the plunder, which meant that the Lord's intention for the golden furnishings in the tabernacle could be fulfilled. So they've still got more, but they won't wear them anymore. And in fact, they don't wear them then until they come to the promised land. Those ornaments are gone. This ritual mourning became the normal way of dress for the rest of their travels. It was an important sign from them of their desire that things could be right with the Lord again. So Moses intercedes for the people, verses 12. There's a little section interspersed there about the tent of meeting. We'll come back to that if we have time a bit later. And he really wrestles with the Lord, because he doesn't want this great disaster of the Lord's absence. He doesn't want that. It won't work. So he intercedes in verses 12 to 16. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you've not let me know whom you'll send with me. Yet you said, I know you by name, and you found favour in my sight. Now therefore, if I have found favour in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favour in your sight. Consider too that this nation is your people." That's verses, and then the Lord answers, "My presence will go with you, and I'll give you rest." The Lord seems so ready to do the turnaround, doesn't he? But he's really wanting Moses to know what's in his heart. Verse 15, Moses replied, "If your presence will not..." It's almost like, I'm not sure you mean what you say yet. "If your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I found favour in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?" What makes the church the church? The Lord is with us. The presence of God. One of the great laments in the Psalms is, "Lord, you go not out with our armies." It's kind of like, that is disaster, isn't it? What's the most important thing for the church today? That God is with us, and that we are his distinct people by his presence, and so by our obedience to his speaking to us. It's so that nothing else actually matters. It's kind of, you know, in the West, it is urgent times. Now, people are writing about who will be the last Christian in Europe. I mean, all the trajectories are that before long, the church will be so small in Europe, it will be completely irrelevant in any way whatsoever, and they will be, Europe will be unreached people groups. That the church will be so small that you won't be able to say that there's, that the gospel is reaching Europe anymore. That there's a certain kind of level that people talk about a group being unreached. It means that to be unreached means that by and large the vast majority of the population will have no possibility of hearing the gospel. Europe is heading that way. You know where else? New Zealand, Australia. Austria is the furthest gone, apparently. And New Zealand is right up there. You know, and these are really urgent times. And we kind of, well, what can we do about that? We actually can't do anything about it. We must seek that God would act among us, and that we would be his holy people. That the only thing we've got, we've got to pray him. The very thing that marks us out as a holy nation and a royal priesthood of people belonging to God is God. His presence among us. That's the only thing that shows the Lord's favour with his people. Well, the Lord answers Moses' prayer with all that he asks, gives it all, and all that he has promised. My presence will go with you, and I will give you your rest. Moses presses further, in effect asking the Lord to guarantee it by putting his honour on the line with it, and the Lord assents. This very thing that you have spoken, I will do. I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. So here, remember, this is all about the names, and now Moses now is finally going to hear this great mysterious name, the Lord. And the Lord's going to proclaim it. In other words, the Lord is going to preach his own name to Moses. He's going to exposit his name to him. It's going to be the best sermon in history. It really is. For the Lord to show his glory, because that's what Moses asked, show me your glory, is to proclaim his name, that is his essential being. The doctrine of the simplicity of God is very important. Have you ever heard of that doctrine? The doctrine of the simplicity of God. Basically, it means that God has no part. He is all together. He's that all together. So when you think about the characteristics of God, you're not really thinking about separable parts. If you think about the holiness, the love, the truth, the goodness and the mercy of God, you've got to think of them all together at the same time. You can't separate. God is one. That's right. Yeah. And so there's no part. When God proclaims his name, he opens up his being, not simply a part of himself. It would be impossible for God to do that because he's not made up of parts. Moses will not be able to encounter God in a bare, full-faced way, for to do so would be to no longer live. I wonder if perhaps the tree of life in the midst of the Garden of Eden was a symbol of the personal presence and knowledge of God. The tree of life, he could live, and you know, could live in the presence of God. Moses can't, so he's to hide in a cleft in a rock, covered by the hand of God. It really is a personal mercy of God that we're not yet exposed to the full light of his glory at this time. And so he's to hide there until the Lord has passed by, before seeing then the back of God. But what a sight that is. what we see now, is it... that song of Jeff, sometimes your living presence is so near. We don't see it all now, but what we see in Christ is so glorious. It's really not the sight of God that the encounter focuses on, though. Rather, it's the hearing of the proclamation and exposition by the Lord of his own holy name. So the Lord said to Moses, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first. I'll write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablet, which you broke. Be ready by the morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite the mountain. So Moses does all that. He cuts the stones and he goes up. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him. So he's clouded. So whatever he sees, it's clouded. But what he does do is he proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generations. So, the Lord, they're the names. That's his name repeated. The Lord, so he's really going to expose it like that. Just to say that the taking of the stone tablets is kind of like going back to the very beginning when the law was first given in chapter 20, and then again in 24 when it's read. But here the Lord descends to him The second line, God, merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, all of that is adjectival. You know what an adjective is? It's a describing word. It describes a thing. So that's all adjectival. And the third and fourth line, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting, the adjective there, the ing word, keeping, visiting, forgiving, they're participles. So the third and fourth ones are participial. Adjectival words really get to the heart of who God is. They describe his essential character. The participial clauses that follow are the actions of God that flow from his character. So the essential truth of God is that he is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That is the essential character of God. That's the wellspring of the covenant with Israel, which has the blessing of the world in view. The future of the world hangs on the goodwill of God, and that goodwill is more than goodwill. It is grace. It is steadfast and faithful, even in the face of a world that's corrupted itself and broken loose, casting off its bonds. This is the very heart of God, and so, and only so, we can say, you have made the world so firm that it can never be shaken. The unshakableness of the earth is not anything about the earth. The unshakableness of the earth is the unshakableness of God in his mercy and forgiveness and grace. The actions that flow from this character of God, though, are less predictable than we might imagine. So they are forgiving and visiting. Forgiving sin and visiting the iniquity. In other words, the out of the mercy and grace and slowness to anger and steadfast love and faithful, abundant steadfast love and faithfulness of God, we have the unpredictable will of God to work that grace through blessing and cursing, through blessing and judgment, through forgiveness and judgment. God works that through in human history, in personal histories all the time. The grace of God, you cannot turn into a law about exactly how God's going to deal in any situation. He has his ways of bringing through to us the knowledge of him as merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. The Lord is not the God of an infinitely weak and benign benediction. Oh, God bless you. Like, if that's how he turned his grace into, that God is always going to smile and hold up his hand and it's all going to be lovely, you know, the ironic blessing, we don't want that ironic blessing of the idolatry. We want the ironic blessing that comes from the holy place and says, the Lord bless you, the Lord keep you, the Lord make his face shine upon you, the Lord be gracious to you, the Lord lift up the countenance of his, the light of his countenance upon you, and the Lord give you his peace. We want that blessing. That's strong and true. The answer to that blessing are his forgiving and visiting works. In order that we would not lose our inheritance. A benign blessing by Aaron led almost to the destruction of the people, didn't it? Good grief. This revelation by the Lord brings Moses to worship for the first time. He talks with the Lord of the sin of the people and their need for pardon. We can only confess sins and seek pardon when we've seen that God is the God of all grace. In Jesus Christ, grace and mercy have appeared. In meeting Jesus Christ, we can finally speak of the unspeakable, confess what's been unable to be uncovered. Sorry, it's not the first time that he speaks with the Lord about the sin of his people, is it? He did speak about it earlier. But when Jesus appears, we can finally speak of the unspeakable. We actually speak about our sins when Jesus appears. We can finally confess what has been unable to be uncovered. We can finally, because in him we meet the God and Father who is giving his son for the sins of the world. Think of all those who stuck for ages of their lives in sin, who fall at Jesus' feet and confess. And they find a new world, a new hope in him. This is the glory of the Father and of the Son. And so Jesus prayed as he went to the cross that the glory, the Father glorify him so that the Son may glorify him. At the cross, the grace and mercy, the abundance of steadfast love and faithfulness, the slowness to anger of the Lord, reaches its climax as he gives that Son, his Son, for the sin of the world, setting his grace full and free on a firm foundation, a grace that is fuller and freer than the pathetic benediction of Aaron and the acceptance mob. A grace that is a power to liberate men and women and children into the covenant of God with the law of the Holy One written on the heart. The Lord's covenant with the people is renewed in chapter 34 with its attendant law and with the promise of inheritance in the land. More, the Lord said that he will do wonders in and through Israel such as never been seen before on the earth. When the Lord abounds in steadfast love and faithfulness in his promises. It's an awesome thing I will do with you. This promise finds its fulfillment in the incarnation of the Son of God and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit first on him and then through him on the church. The construction of the tabernacle is detailed carefully in chapters 35 to 39, and the workers who prepare everything are blessed by Moses when they're done, for it's all done in faithfulness to the Lord's command. Then the pieces are brought together and the tabernacle is erected, and then that, the beginning of chapter 40 I think, and then the promise is kept, that impossible promise given all that Israel have done in rebellion, but that is possible because of the Lord's own being. The promise is kept as the cloud that covered the mountain shifts over to cover the tent, and the glory of the Lord, all that glory that Moses saw, fills the tabernacle. That's the presence of God among his people. The Lord, merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. That glory cloud stays all through the wanderings of the desert, through to the land. Whenever the cloud moved, they would set out, and if it remained, they would stay. Israel, the holy nation, and royal priesthood, has the presence of the Lord with them. And that's it. Run through the book of Exodus. I'm going to keep reading it, and as I said, there's actually so many of the Psalms are full of Exodus themes. It's really worth just reading that through. I mean, there's explicit references to Exodus all the way through the Psalms, but there's just so many themes, resonances of Exodus through the Psalms. And so we can read them, because we've gone through the great Exodus in Jesus Christ, and we can read those Psalms, and they're telling us so much about Jesus Christ. Thank you.